Bonsoir à chacune et chacun d'entre vous et bienvenue pour cette soirée au Centre Sèvres. Nous sommes très heureux d'accueillir le père John O'Malley, jésuite des États-Unis, qui enseigne dans le département de théologie de Georgetown. John O'Malley est surtout connu en France pour son livre « L'événement Vatican II », que vous trouvez d'ailleurs en vente juste à la sortie de la salle, hein, qui a été traduit chez Lessius et qui, je crois, aide beaucoup à revivre ce qui s'est passé lors du Concile, à en comprendre les enjeux théologiques, ainsi qu'à remettre cet événement dans l'histoire de l'Église. Et ce soir, John O'Malley poursuivra ce travail de lecture en allant jusqu'au temps présent, puisqu'il prolongera sa réflexion en se demandant quelle lumière les tonalités du pontificat du pape François jettent sur le Concile, quelle interprétation du Concile Vatican II peut-on découvrir avec le pape François. Mais John O'Malley, c'est aussi et d'abord un historien de la culture religieuse de la première modernité européenne, autrement dit du XVIe siècle, XVIe-XVIe siècle. Et il est également connu pour son ouvrage « Les premiers jésuites » qui a été publié en 93 et qui a été traduit en 11 langues, bientôt 12 même. On peut citer aussi son travail sur « The Jesuits, Culture, Science and the Arts », un ouvrage publié en 2005 et 2006, en deux volumes, qui est vraiment une mine. Et puis, nous avons maintenant accès, et c'est tout récent, à son livre en français sur le Concile de Trente. Le Concile de Trente, ce qui s'est vraiment passé. Ouvrage que vous trouverez aussi à la sortie, et qui est traduit aussi par Lessius, qui, une fois encore, nous rend un précieux service. Professeur O'Malley, chers compagnons jésuites, nous sommes très heureux de vous accueillir ce soir. Merci beaucoup d'avoir accepté notre invitation. Merci aussi à Nicolas Steves, qui est doctorant ici au Centre Sèvres, qui est en train de mettre la dernière main à sa thèse en théologie sur la place de l'imagination en théologie fondamentale, et qui soutiendra bientôt, et qui nous aidera ce soir pour traduire. Donc vous pourrez poser des questions en français. Nicolas les traduira pour le père O'Malley, et puis éventuellement les réponses aussi seront traduites, même si c'est un petit résumé de ce que dira John O'Malley. Voilà. Merci aussi à Antoine Pommard et à Grégoire Cata, qui sont jésuites doctorants et qui ont traduit la conférence de John O'Malley en français, si bien que vous allez pouvoir la suivre au fur et à mesure que le père O'Malley parlera, vous pourrez la suivre sur cet écran. Voilà. Eh bien, je vous souhaite un très bon moment. Et puis, ben, Père O'Malley, à vous la parole. Merci.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. And I apologize for speaking in English, but what can I do? Vatican II revisited the Francis factor. Vatican II opened over 50 years ago. This stark fact reminds us that between then and now, the Council has inexorably moved from experience to memory and finally to history. For everybody in the world today under 60 years of age, the Council is at best nothing more than an item in a textbook or perhaps something they have heard their grandparents speak about. Pope Francis is the first pope in 50 years not to have participated in the Council. He marks thus the end of an era and perhaps the beginning of a new era. For us who study the Council, this situation offers an occasion to step back to take a bigger look at it. Instead of our usual practice of considering the Council's 16 final documents one by one without regard for the whole corpus, we can take a deep breath, look at them as constituting a single corpus, and ask ourselves, what happened. We can in this way revisit the council and in so doing also take account of the event that occurred on March the 13th, 2013, the election as Pope of Jorge Mario Bergoglio. That is what I will try to do this evening. To provide the full perspective on the council, we need even to step back from the 16-document corpus to take into consideration other official documents pertinent to Vatican II. Among them, for instance, is the message to the world that the council issued on October the 20th, 1962, less than 2 weeks after it opened. The document spelled out clearly the basic framework within which the council wanted to work. Quotation, "We urgently turn our thoughts to the problems by which human beings are afflicted today. Like Christ, we would have pity on the multitude heavily burdened by hunger, misery, and lack of education. As we understand our task, therefore, we would emphasize whatever concerns the dignity of the human person and whatever contributes to the genuine community of peoples." Close quotation. In his very first moment, therefore, the council turned its gaze outward and sounded a positive note, a note of compassion. The message did not come out of nowhere. When Pope John the 23rd convoked the council, he in gentle but firm ways gave it a direction. He had had an experience of the world wider and more direct than any pope for centuries. As a young priest, he served as a medical orderly or chaplain in the Italian army during World War I. He afterwards spent decades as papal diplomat among either predominantly Orthodox or Muslim populations. While stationed in Istanbul during World War II, he had firsthand experienced the plight of Jewish refugees from Nazi persecution and did his best to help them. He later performed well as nuncio in Paris at a most delicate time for the church in the immediate post-war years. Then before his election as Pope, he served with distinction as Archbishop, that is Patriarch, of Venice. We should not be surprised, therefore, that on the day of the Council's opening, October the 11th, 1962, he introduced the theme of reconciliation. In his address, Gaudet Mater Ecclesia, Mother Church Rejoices, the Pope indicated to the Council his hopes for it. We now know that Pope John wrote the address entirely on his own, revising it again and again. Every word was carefully chosen. The message to the world 2 weeks later is, in fact, best interpreted as the Council's first response to the Pope's address. When the address is put into the context of papal pronouncements of the previous century and a half, its force and distinctive character clearly emerge. To begin with, the Pope distanced himself, and therefore the Council, from a scolding and suspicious approach towards the world. He expressed the hope that the council would, quotation, face the future without fear, close quotation. The church should deal with both what was right and what was wrong in today's society, but in a positive way, quotation, making use of the medicine of mercy rather than severity, demonstrating the validity of the church's teaching rather than by condemnations. He thus raised the critical question of the council's style of discourse and specified it as predominantly pastoral, because the church through the council, quotation, desires to show herself to be the loving mother of all, benign, patient, full of mercy and goodness. Although John did not use the word reconciliation, that is what he was talking about. And I think it's significant that in the apostolic exhortation, Pope Francis quotes that address in two places. The Council Fathers did not have to wait until the Council opened to know what Pope John wanted to accomplish. On January the 25th, 1959, when he announced his intention to convoke the Council, he specified two general goals for it. The first was to promote, quotation, the enlightenment, edification, and joy of the entire Christian people, close quotation. And the second was to extend, quotation, a renewed cordial invitation to the faithful of the separated communities to participate with us in this quest for unity and grace for which so many souls long in all parts of the world. John shortly afterwards established the Secretariat for Christian Unity, and he later constituted it a full-fledged commission of the Council with the right to create and submit documents for action, just as the other commissions did. By word and deed, therefore, Pope John made reconciliation a goal of the Council. Vatican II was an enormously complex event. It cannot be reduced to one word or to a simplistic formula. Nonetheless, we must never forget that the documents of Vatican II are not a grab bag of discrete elements. Unlike the documents of previous councils, those of Vatican II form a coherent unit. That is, certain themes and orientations run through them as common threads. These themes and orientations transcend the individual documents, even though they are derived from them. The documents of Vatican II thus deliver messages bigger than those of the individual documents considered in isolation from one another. Because of the Council's complexity, different approaches are needed to grasp its meaning. A fruitful approach, I believe, is to focus on two of its special characteristics. The first is to examine the crisis in Catholicism that the Council was first to confront, and the second, as I have already intimated, is to examine the literary genre or style the Council employed to formulate its decrees. I will analyze these two characteristics, demonstrate their affinity with each other, and describe the significance of the result. I will finally briefly suggest how Pope Francis, in these early months of his pontificate, has begun to carry the result forward. The crisis of modernity. It is often asserted of Vatican II that, unlike previous ecumenical councils, it met without being faced with a crisis that demanded action. The assertion is false on two counts. First, at least a few councils, such as Lateran I and Lateran II, met without an immediate crisis or just after the crisis had been resolved. Second, and most important, Vatican II met in a period of profound crisis, not only for Catholicism, but for all Christian churches. It was a crisis all the more serious for not being clearly perceived as such at the time, or at least not clearly named. Yet the crisis was real, pervasive, and far-reaching in its ramifications, perhaps the most serious and radical in the history of Christianity. We can call it, for lack of a better word, the crisis of modernity. This is not to say that the fathers of the Council were utterly unaware of what was happening. They both wittingly and unwittingly responded to it, and they did so largely in positive terms, designating it as a new era opening up for the Church and for humanity at large. The crisis had roots deep in history. It was early propelled on its way by the scientific and industrial revolutions, but took on its sharpest characteristics after the French Revolution during the century and a half leading up to Vatican II. That is the period I have called the long 19th century. The Church, in its official pronouncements during this era, almost invariably assumed a sharply negative stance towards every aspect of the modern world. Although it gradually softened its stance, it never officially repudiated it. That changed with Vatican II. A stance of reconciliation replaced a stance of alienation. The modern world. A phenomenon so complex as to be intractable. I will limit myself to five aspects that are particularly pertinent to the Council. They are, in the order in which I will treat them, 1, first, multiculturalism, 2, religious pluralism. 3, radical political and social shifts provoking a crisis of authority. 4, the emergence of a newly sharp historical consciousness, now applied even to sacred subjects. And 5, the social, economic, and cultural situations of the men and women of today. First, multiculturalism. The world has, of course, always been multicultural, but air travel, television, and forced migrations made it a fact of daily life that has only increased in intensity in the years since the Council. Moreover, in the 1960s and 1970s, the violent end of colonialism and the resulting animus against Western cultural imperialism raised profound questions about the degree missionaries had acted as unofficial agents for their respective governments and cultures. The situation raised the symptomatic question of the role of Latin liturgy at the moment when the great newly decolonized countries demanded recognition of the dignity of the usages of their indigenous cultures. The Church had, of course, consistently presented itself as Catholics in the sense of embracing all peoples. Although there was considerable truth in the claim, Catholicism was so strongly imprinted with the culture of the West as to seem almost identical with it. There had been important efforts to address the problem, as with the Jesuits in China in the 17th century, led by Matteo Ricci. But in the 18th century, the Holy See condemned such experiments, and during the 19th and early 20th centuries, both Catholic and Protestant missionaries saw themselves as bearing the white man's burden of bringing civilization, that is, Western ways, to their flocks. It was this approach that the Council gently but firmly repudiated. The Council's very first document, the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, Sacro Sanctum Concilium, in effect directed the Church to break out of its Eurocentrism and to admit other cultures as partners. Sacro Sanctum is crucially important issues beyond what it prescribed for liturgy. Among those issues was the crisis of multiculturalism, to which it responded in unmistakably clear terms. It set the Council on a course when it affirmed, quotation, "The Church cultivates and fosters the qualities and talents of different races and nations, and it admits their customs into the liturgy itself, provided they harmonize with its true and authentic spirit." The idea recurs in the decree on the Church's missionary activity, Ad Gentes, as when it stipulates, "The faith should be imparted by means of a well-adapted catechesis and celebrated in a liturgy that is in harmony with the character of the people." Two, religious pluralism. The most obvious and direct acts of reconciliation at the Council were the decrees on ecumenism, Unitatis Rei Integratio, and non-Christian religions, Nostra Aetate. The former opens, quotation, "The restoration of unity among Christians is one of the principal concerns of the Second Vatican Council." It goes on to tell Catholics to respect the beliefs of those not in communion with the Church, and it prescribes a process of dialogue with them. Such steps might seem cautious and minimal, but they amounted to a dramatic reversal of the policy of belittling and condemning other Christian bodies and of counseling Catholics to avoid, as possible, all contact with them. Moreover, in 1928, Pope Pius XI, excuse me, this will pass. Moreover, in 1928, Pope Pius XI, in his encyclical Mortalium Animos, forbade Catholic participation in the ecumenical movement that had been gaining in importance since the beginning of the century, and wanted to enlist Catholics in its cause. The decree on ecumenism signaled a change of 180 degrees, so much so that a small minority during and after the council denounced it as heretical. However, as a result of decades of study and conversation carried on semi-officially and behind the scenes in the 1940s and 1950s, the council accepted the decree with unexpected ease. After centuries of alienation, which seemed only to exasperate an already bad situation, the time had arrived for seeking common ground. John XXIII himself initiated the process that ended with Nostra Aetate. Out of his deep concern about anti-Semitism and Christian responsibility regarding the Holocaust, he mandated that the council consider a document on the Jews. No doubt, for many prelates at the council, it was the growing awareness of the horror of the Holocaust that made such a statement imperative. Nonetheless, Nostra Aetate did not enjoy the same easy course through the council as did Unitatis Rei Integratio. The opposition to it was so fierce that it was almost withdrawn from the agenda. In its early drafts, Nostra Aetate dealt exclusively with the Jews. Objections were raised to it on theological grounds, but also on political. The prospect of the document stirred up fear in Arab countries that this was a step towards Vatican diplomatic recognition of the State of Israel, which up to that point the Vatican had not done. The Council was finally able to convince them that Nostra Aetate had nothing to do with politics, and meanwhile, exegetes and theologians were able to convince an overwhelming majority of the bishops of the theological acceptability of the document. The Jews were not an accursed people. With such problems resolved, Nostra Aetate won approval, but only after it was expanded to include other non-Christian religions, most notably the Muslims. The small minority in the council that rejected Unitatis Rei Integratio rejected this document even more fiercely. Nostra Aetate finally and categorically marked the official end of Catholic-inspired pogroms against the Jews and Holy Crusades against the Muslims. Few decrees of the council seem more timely today. Nostra Aetate sounds a note of reason and compassion, is the diametrical opposite of hate-inspired polemics, and invests the Catholic Church and individual Catholics with a newly minted role as agents of reconciliation in the present tense international situation. The Catholic way is not to respond to violence with more violence, but to wash the feet of those perceived to be one's enemies. 3. Radical political and social shifts. With its cry of liberty, equality, and fraternity, the French Revolution upset the hierarchical paradigm that had undergirded Western society until that moment. And it especially challenged even mitigated versions of the divine right of kings. It toppled rulers from their thrones. If those rulers returned, it was often for a limited time, and surely with rights and duties dramatically and drastically trimmed. In mid-century, therefore, furthermore, Marx and Engels issued their rallying cry in the Communist Manifesto, "Workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains." Thus took place a series of social, economic, and political revolutions, massive in their implications and without parallel in the history of the world. It provoked a profound crisis of authority. Who is in charge here? Whence is authority to govern derived? What are the limits of even legitimate authority? Not new questions, surely, but now newly urgent and newly explosive. The papacy had stock answers to these questions and had viewed the changes that were taking place as inversions of the divinely ordered structure of the universe. Authority flowed from the highest to the middlemost and from the middlemost to the lowest. liberty was a bad word. But bit by bit, especially beginning with Pope Leo XIII, the Pope's attitude began to soften. When in his landmark encyclical Rerum Novarum, 1891, Leo conceded that workers had the right to organize in order to secure their rights, he shocked and scandalized the Catholic social elite. Pope Pius XII's Christmas message, 1944, broadcast worldwide, marked the first time a pope ever positively praised democracy as a political form, which he described as particularly, quotation, compatible with the dignity and liberty of citizens. By the end of World War II, liberty had begun to work its way into standard Catholic vocabulary, as evidenced from the emergence of Christian democratic parties led by Catholics, de Gaulle, Adenauer, de Gasperi, and others. But did liberty extend to the choice of one's religion? The Holy Office adamantly denied that it did. It still clung firmly to the ideal of the confessional state, in which the state supported the church even to the point of enforcing civil disabilities against members of other churches and religions. The Council's Declaration on Religious Liberty, Dignitatis Humanae, responded to this situation and in so doing reconciled the church to the issue of freedom of conscience that had become so paramount in modern discussions of the role of the state in religious matters. Like Nostra Aetate, this document had an especially troubled history in the Council, and like Nostra Aetate, its future at one point seemed in such danger that its sponsors considered withdrawing it from the agenda. Discussions about religious liberty often seemed to assume that democracy was the form of government most likely to promise and to promote and ensure it. Implicit in such an assumption was that authority to govern did not descend from on high, but was a result of consent freely given. The question was inevitable. What did this mean for the structure of authority in the church itself? Of course, the church was divinely founded on the rock of Peter, whose successors had the primacy among all bishops. That much was unquestioned and unquestionable. But in what fashion was the primacy to be exercised? That was the question the Council undertook to answer. For several decades before the Council, scholars had begun to question the strongly ultramontane interpretations of the church, of church history, that predominated through most of the long 19th century. They had begun to show that through the first millennium and well beyond, the church had, for the most part, functioned in a synodal fashion, that is, through local councils, with the papacy intervening in their process only as a final arbiter in disputes. Moreover, in a remarkable study published in 1955, Brian Tierney rescued conciliarism from the categorical rejection of it in vogue after the rise of ultramontanism. He showed that medieval canonists taught that responsibility for the good of the church was distributed among various offices and corporations in which the episcopal office reigned above all others. Each of these offices had its own intrinsic, not delegated authority. By the time of the Council, the stage had been set for the Constitution on the Church Lumen Gentium to propose to the Council the doctrine of episcopal collegiality. That doctrine, solidly based on the tradition of the Church, was not an attempt to democratize the Church in order to make it more amenable to modern sensibilities. Nonetheless, those sensibilities acted as a catalyst to bring the teaching to the fore, and in fact, the teaching on collegiality helped make the authority structure of the Church seem less like a vestige of the most extreme form of divine right monarchy of the 17th century. The Council proposed a collegial, not monarchical relationship between the Pope and the bishops, And then it went on to propose the same for bishops with their priests and priests with their flock. For historical consciousness. The recovery of the doctrine of collegiality in the decades before the council points to a sharpened sense of historical consciousness, of discrepancy between the past and the present, as one of the most salient intellectual characteristics of the long 19th century. During this period, a historical approach to virtually every subject, including sacred subjects, took deep hold. This development challenged the seemingly devastating force, the boast that the Catholic Church does not change. In instance after instance, historians showed how the Church had, in fact, changed. How was the Church to deal with such phenomena? Perhaps even more troubling was the increasingly widespread acceptance of Darwin's Origin of the Species, 1859. What did this do to the story of Adam and Eve and the biblical account of the origins of the human race? How is it possible to save the authority of the sacred text in the face of such criticism? How is it possible to assert continuity with the apostolic past in the face of ever-mounting evidence of discontinuity with it? Awareness of historical change in its acute modern form developed in the years before the Council as a pervasive and constitutive element in the crisis of modernity that faced the Council. Pope John had himself implicitly introduced the issue when he sounded aggiornamento, updating, a form of change, as one of the Council's principal tasks. And to the Council's credit, it did not dodge the problem. The word change itself, mutatio, in other words indicating change, appear prominently in the very first sentence of the very first document of the Council, Sacro Sanctum Concilium. Quotation, is the intention of this Holy Council to improve, augere, the standard of daily Christian living among Catholics, to adapt, accommodare, those structures that are subject to change, mutationes, so as better to meet the needs of our time. Change became a theme of the Council that reached its climax in the Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes. In that document, words like change, progress, development, and even evolution appear frequently, characteristically, and in a positive sense. Blessed John Henry Newman's Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine, 1845, provided the Council with its greatest help in this regard. Newman used different analogies to show how teachings could evolve while still remaining fundamentally true to their origins. Vatican II, of course, did not solve the problem of the relationship between continuity and discontinuity in the tradition of the Church. But it took heed of the problem and recognized that change is just as important in trying to understand the tradition as is continuity. Providing a theoretical solution to the problem of change within continuity fell outside the Council's agenda and its competence. The merit of the Council is that it reconciled the Church to the problem by recognizing its existence, by taking account of its importance, and by providing a few examples of where it has operated in the long tradition of the Church. 5. The men and women of today. Although reconciliation implicitly pervades the Council's documents from beginning to end, it most clearly emerges in Gaudium et Spes. About that document, we need to note two important facts. First, the title of the document is The Church in the Modern World, not the Church for the Modern World, not the Church against the Modern World. In other words, the Council recognized as a fact of life that each and every one of us, even Church members, constitute the modern world. We cannot in any way step out of that reality, even if we want to. Therefore, neither can the Church step out of it. Second, for the first time in the history of the Church, a Council document addressed not Church members only, but all humanity. As it says, the Second Vatican Council now immediately addresses itself not just to the Church's own daughters and sons and all who call upon the name of Christ, but to people everywhere. It sees the world as the world of men and women, the whole human family in its total environment, the stage of human history notable for its toil, its tragedies, and triumphs. The world that Christians believe has been established and kept in being by the Creator's love, liberated from sin by Christ, so that it could be transformed according to God's promise and come to its fulfillment. Although the church-world relationship was not on the agenda when the council opened, it had clearly emerged by the end of the council's first year. No wonder, for it took up in explicit way the theme of reconciliation with the modern world that Pope John proposed in his opening address. Beyond recognizing that the church is now and ever has been in the world, the document takes the further step of recognizing the consequences of that fact. The church and world are reciprocally dependent. Quotation, "The church as at the same time an identifiable group and a spiritual community, proceeds on its way with the whole of humanity and shares the world's earthly lot while also being a leaven and a sort of soul of human society." Yanni Mitzpes then elaborates on how the church contributes to the well-being of the world, but most remarkably, then elaborates on what the world contributes to the well-being of the church. When the council directed Gaudium et Spes to all persons of goodwill, whether believers or not, it extended reconciliation to its ultimate limits. Gaudium et Spes is therefore a fitting way to conclude our examination of five ways in which the council tried to respond to the crisis of modernity. John the 23rd's opening address sounded the theme of reconciliation, but in an understated and altogether generic way. The council took up reconciliation as a fundamental orientation and imbued it with remarkable scope. It extended it to the church's relationship to non-Western cultures, to non-Catholic Christians, to non-Christian believers, to the new economic, social, and political situation of the modern world, to the problem of change, and its final document, to all humanity. The style of discourse adopted by the council. This is the second characteristic of the council I said I would speak about. I have written extensively about it and therefore can be relatively brief. To understand the turn the council took concerning the style of its documents, we must return again to Pope John's opening address. In it, as I mentioned, he told the council to make use of the medicine of mercy rather than of severity, demonstrating the validity of the church's teaching rather than by condemnations. And he thus put style on the agenda. It is understandable that interpreters have generally been content to designate the council's style as pastoral and leave it at that. Yes, indeed, the style was pastoral. But that does not tell us much. We can and need to be more specific. I argue that the dominant and most characteristic feature of the council's style is what is technically known as epideictic or demonstrative rhetoric, in other words, panegyric, eulogy. The choice of that form fostered the emergence of a distinctive vocabulary, which after form is the second element that determines the style of Vatican II. The third element is the intertextual character of the documents, that is, they build upon one another, paraphrase one another, qualify one another, and in so doing, bind them together into a thematic unity. To summarize, the three constitutive elements of the style of Vatican II are form, vocabulary, and intertextuality, each of which helps determine the other two to create a coherent corpus. It was the ancient theorists about rhetoric, among whom the better known today are Cicero and Quintilian, who isolated and described the epideictic category. For those theorists, rhetoric meant, first and foremost, the art of oratory. It was the act of persuasion, that is, the art of winning consensus. The art of it.
Yeah. He's confused with the screen.
Okay. I'm trying to win consensus, but I'm not doing too well. Shall I pick up where I left off?
Yeah.
Yeah.
we're not even off. Okay. To summarize, the three constitutive elements of the style of Vatican II are form, vocabulary, and intertextuality, each of which helps determine the other two to create a coherent corpus. It was the ancient theorists about rhetoric, among whom the better known today are Cicero and Quintilian, who isolated and described the epideictic category. For these theorists, rhetoric meant first and foremost the art of oratory. It was the art of persuasion, that is, the art of winning consensus, the art of inducing an audience to work together in a common cause or to share appreciation for certain ideals and values. It was the art of persuading audiences to reconcile their differences so that they might together contribute to something greater. To that extent, rhetoric was the art of reconciliation. Epideictic was one of several instantiations of rhetoric, one of its genres. It was generally exercised in a ceremonial situation where the purpose was to win appreciation for persons or institutions or to denigrate them so as to make them repugnant. The ars laudandi et vituperandi. Epideictic holds up ideals for emulation. Epideictic is a fancy name for something we experience every day, even though its practitioners may not recognize that they are conforming to ancient theory. We experience it, for instance, sometimes in homilies in church, but certainly in every funeral eulogy and in every patriotic speech. The most sublime, for instance, of it in American history is Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, the middle of the Civil War. Lincoln was not trying to accuse the Confederacy of perfidy, nor was he arguing that the bloody Civil War was just. He was trying simply to raise appreciation for what was at stake in the war and present it as a noble enterprise worthy of the great cost. Like the man who did not know he had been speaking prose all his life, the prelates at Vatican II did not know they were writing epideictic. But that is not a problem if we pay heed to the ancient theorists on rhetoric. Those theorists maintained that their categories were simply a codification of life as they observed it. In other words, epideictic existed before the theorists named and classified it. I would even venture to say that every society and culture throughout history has practiced it in some form or other. We human beings want to praise good and noble things. As Augustine says in the opening paragraph of the Confessions, we were born to praise. How did the Council come to adopt that form? On October 22, 1962, Cardinal Joseph Franks of Cologne explicitly brought the question onto the floor when, as the very first person to speak, on the very first working day of the Council, he commended Sacrosanctum Concilium, the very first document to be presented to the Council, quotation, for its modest and truly pastoral style, full of Holy Scripture and the fathers of the Church. His words set the tone, as subsequent events showed. The prelates at the Council wanted to take a positive approach, and they knew that that meant abandoning, or at least radically modifying, the way most of the draft documents prepared for them had been formulated. To understand the problem, we need to look at how previous councils conceived of themselves. Even though there were important councils before Nicaea, the first ecumenical council, 325, we can take Nicaea as our paradigm. It is fair to say that when Emperor Constantine convoked it, he saw it in some sense, some measure, the ecclesiastical equivalent of the Roman Senate. What the Roman Senate did was make laws and render verdicts in high-level criminal cases. It was concerned with public order in the empire. Nicaea was concerned with public order in the church, whether regarding proper teaching or proper discipline. It therefore issued laws prescribing or proscribing certain behaviors and heard the case against Arius, accused of the ecclesiastical crime of spreading heresy. Laws invariably carry penalties for non-observance, and negative verdicts in criminal cases carry even heavier penalties. With Nicaea, the pattern was set. Although in pursuing the goal of public order, later councils adopted a number of literary forms, the most prevalent was the canon, a short ordinance prescribing or proscribing some action. Canons commonly ended with an anathema, that is, a sentence of excommunication. When Vatican II opened, the canon was far from being an irrelevant relic of the past. The Roman Synod that Pope John convoked in 1960, often considered at the time as a dress rehearsal for Vatican II, issued 755 canons. This language tradition was precisely what the Council wanted to avoid. But what to put in its place? The question continued to be raised through the whole of the first period, October to December 1962. At that point, the Council was clearer on what it did not want than on what it wanted to replace it. Nonetheless, by the opening of the second period in September 1963, Vatican II had begun to find its voice, as expressed especially in the first chapter of Lumen Gentium, the first document on the agenda for that period. In witting or unwitting homage to Henri de Lubac's Méditations sur l'Église, the first chapter of the document bore the same title as the first chapter of de Lubac's book, The Mystery of the Church. Just as important, in a general way, that chapter, plus most of the rest of the text, adopted the literary style of de Lubac's book, which was a book of ecclesiology. The chapter, for instance, almost overflows with images of the church and its members that suggest fecundity, dignity, abundance, goodness, safe haven, welcome, communion, tenderness, and warmth. It was thus a dramatic break with the legalistic and even polemical style of ecclesiological textbooks of the period. De Lubac was inspired by the fathers of the church. We must recall that the system of education which the fathers were trained from their earliest days was rhetorical. Rhetoric was the culmination of the education that almost universally prevailed in the early Christian centuries. For de Lubac and others like him, this rhetorical style provided a welcome alternative to the dry, cerebral, dialectical style prevalent in theology at the time, which was a rundown form of neo-scholasticism. To that extent, epidictic was also an alternative to the scholastic underpinnings of the theological enterprise of the times. Consonant with the new style was Lumen Gentium's adoption of dialogue as one of its most characteristic words, a word no previous council had ever uttered, and a striking indication of the new vocabulary the new form would introduce into the documents of the council from this point forward. The vocabulary consisted in words of friendship, partnership, reciprocity, mutual esteem, service, human dignity, and a Christian optimism about the possibilities of the contemporary situation. The vocabulary was further propelled forward by two closely related concepts Lumen Gentium introduced into the council that henceforth became council themes, even though they were at times hotly contested. The first was the description of the church as the people of God, an important qualification of the then prevalent image of the church as a monarchy, a strictly top-down institution. The second, clearly consonant with the first, was collegiality, which implied reciprocity, respect for the other, and willingness to work together in common cause. Meanwhile, the decrees on ecumenism and on non-Christian religions abandoned, as I mentioned, the fault-finding attitude and vocabulary of previous ecclesiastical documents and theological textbooks. In the Declaration on Religious Liberty, Dignitatis Humanae, the primacy of conscience in moral decision-making emerged with a clarity new in the history of ecumenical councils. As a striking instance of the intertextual character of the council's documents, Gaudium et Spes carried the theme of conscience further, describing it as the secret core and sanctuary of the human person, as the interior law inscribed on our hearts. The adoption of epidictic rhetoric had an important theological repercussion. It inclined the council to favor a theology more incarnational than eschatological, a theology more inclined to emphasize the goodness of creation and the incarnation than original sin and the atonement, a theology closer to Thomas Aquinas than Martin Luther, more reminiscent of the fathers of the Eastern Church than St. Augustine, more inclined to reconciliation with human culture than alienation from it. In that theology, grace is not alien to nature, but consonant with it. Grace is reconciled with nature. In the classic expression, grace perfects nature. The adoptive apodictic meant that the documents of the council, when viewed as a single, coherent corpus, called for a significant attitude shift and consequently a behavior shift on the part of all Catholics and especially on the part of the leaders of the Church. It thus prescribed that the Church assume a certain style, a style that revealed the Church's deepest and most genuine personality, a style that radiated benignity, patience, mercy, and goodness, to echo the words of Pope John. Aspects of the attitudinal and behavioral shifts characteristic of that personality can be expressed as follows. From commands to invitations, from threats to persuasion, from coercion to conscience, from monologue to dialogue, from sin obsession to recognition of dignity, from top down to shared, from monarch to servant leader, from exclusion to inclusion, from hostility to friendship, from rivalry to partnership, from fault-finding to search for common ground, from contempt to appreciation, from behavior modification to inner appropriation of values. In summary, from alienation to reconciliation. The Francis Factor. With the election to the papacy of Jorge Mario Bergoglio, reconciliation overnight assumed a prominence in papal agenda that it had not had since the pontificate of John XXIII. Although the popes in the intervening decades kept the ideal alive, none made it as central to his agenda as Pope Francis has already made it in these early months after his election. There is no reason to think that as long as he is pope, it will lose its centrality for him. While Vatican II was in session, Bergoglio was a young Jesuit in faraway Argentina. Everything he knew or learned about the council was secondhand. Nonetheless, his words and deeds as pope have indicated that he fully interiorized the council's basic orientation. Perhaps his non-participation has in fact been an advantage. It can be argued that his predecessors could never fully extricate themselves from the battles they had fought in the council. Francis is free of those battles and those memories. He now seems implicitly to be asking us to step back, to put behind us the memories of liturgical wars, doctrinal wars, and other wars in which we have been engaged in the past 50 years, and now to turn our gaze outward. He invites us to revisit the council and see it with fresh eyes. Just how Jorge Mario Bergoglio developed into the kind of person he is has already been the subject of a number of studies. He has himself spoken frankly about how much he has changed and developed over the course of the years. Fascinating though we might find the unfolding of his life story, it is less important than the kind of person he has turned out to be and the kind of church of which he hopes to be the living exemplar, which he just described, I think, so well in his apostolic exhortation of 2 weeks ago. He set the pattern while Archbishop of Buenos Aires, most notably in the dialogue he conducted with Rabbi Abraham Skorka. In the history of the church, no pope has ever in his life sat down with a non-Christian to have a one-on-one conversation about each other's religious beliefs and other beliefs. The conversation with Rabbi Skorka was not a single encounter, but went on for months and covered a range of issues. It was carried on as a genuine dialogue. That is, not an attempt to convert the other, but simply to understand him and to appreciate why he believed as he did. Out of that dialogue developed a deep friendship, as I myself was privileged to learn from Rabbi Skorka himself a few weeks ago. When shortly after Bergoglio's election, he created the commission of 8 cardinals from around the world to advise him about a wide range of church matters, especially the reform of the Roman Curia. He seemed to suggest that dialogue within the church would be as prominent a feature of his pontificate as dialogue with those outside the church. As strictly advisory, the commission does not quite fulfill what the council intended by ratifying the doctrine of episcopal collegiality, but it seems to be a first step in furthering the teaching of the council. Pope Francis' deeds thus speak even louder than his words. When just a few weeks after he was elected, he on Holy Thursday washed the feet of the Muslim woman, an infidel, as we used to say, and a convicted criminal, he sent a powerful message. Even more powerful was his trip on July the 8th, 2013, to the island of Lampedusa. It was the first time since his election that he ventured outside Rome. It is no accident that his first trip was a spontaneous and heartfelt gesture of compassion. He went to Lampedusa to comfort the African refugees, most of whom were Muslims, in their grief, desperation, and despair over their situation and over the tragic loss of life of others seeking haven there. In words unusually harsh for him, Pope Francis afterwards denounced the globalization of indifference, of which the world's indifference to Lampedusa tragedy was but an instance. The Pope is showing us how we must revisit Vatican II. In a world racked by discord, war, threat of nuclear proliferation, hate-spewing blogs, and a globalization of indifference toward the suffering of others, even when it is on a massive scale, he takes seriously the new mission of reconciliation the Council gave the Church. What did I say? The new mission? No. The old mission of reconciliation. Vatican II simply reminds us of it. In word and deed, Pope Francis is showing us that he takes it seriously. He takes seriously the Church's oldest and most fundamental mission, which the Council, following the lead of Pope John XXIII, tried simply to update. That is the mission, in Pope John's own words, to show the Church to be the loving mother of all, benign, patient, full of mercy and goodness. Merci.
Grand merci, John O'Malley, pour cette conférence passionnante et cette lecture qui montre, je crois, tout ce que on peut gagner d'une attention à l'histoire pour comprendre l'Église et aussi pour réfléchir sur des questions théologiques. Je retiens notamment dans ce que vous avez dit, mais aussi parce que ça vient en écho avec ce dont on parlait cet après-midi avec les doctorants, ce que vous avez dit sur l'importance de la manière de parler. La rhétorique qui est choisie par le Concile et qui est beaucoup plus qu'une simple question de forme, mais qui engage une manière de comprendre la bonne nouvelle. Je crois que ça rejoint des réflexions qui se tiennent ici dans cette maison autour de la notion de principe de pastoralité qui a été avancée par Christophe Théobald. Voilà une manière un peu autre de concevoir la révélation où l'accueil de la révélation fait partie de la révélation. J'ai aussi ma petite question que j'amène au pot commun des questions au sujet de ce que vous avez dit sur la réconciliation. Je trouve que l'Église et le pape François aussi, tout en mettant les accents sur la réconciliation, comme vous l'avez dit, garde une capacité, on pourrait dire, de s'opposer, ou une capacité de dire le tranchant de la bonne nouvelle. Ce n'est pas une réconciliation qui rend la bonne nouvelle inoffensive. Alors ma question, ça serait, mais du coup, comment qualifier cette manière de faire entendre le tranchant de l'Évangile sans fermeture ni condamnation? Voilà, et si je pose cette question, c'est que je pense que nous en avons besoin pour l'Église. Alors peut-être, on n'est pas obligé de... Enfin, peut-être on peut prendre les questions par petits paquets. Comme ça, ça laissera le temps de prendre un peu de distance par rapport à elle. Donc, si quelqu'un veut bien faire circuler, ben, merci beaucoup Antoine. On peut prendre, peut-être, on prendra les questions 3 par 3, et puis à chaque fois, John O'Malley pourra après répondre.
May I answer your question?
No, we will hear two other questions. And then,
Oh, it's too much. All right, bon.
Voilà, donc la parole est à vous.
Bon.
Oui, vous avez beaucoup parlé donc de la manière dont Vatican II a introduit quand même un changement dans la continuité. Alors, je ne voudrais pas revenir sur la fameuse herméneutique de Benoît XVI. Hein. Est-ce que Vatican II a été continuité ou réforme? Mais est-ce que selon vous, ce nouveau pape François est vraiment en rupture avec les deux papes précédents, Benoît XVI et Jean-Paul II, ou est-ce qu'il y a quand même une forme de continuité entre lui et les deux papes précédents? Est-ce qu'on est vraiment, vous avez dit en début de votre conférence, qu'on est entré dans une ère nouvelle? Alors ça m'interpelle un peu.
More or less. Let me answer that because I'll forget.
You prefer?
Yes, it's better for me, yes.
Ma question sera très brève. Vous n'avez jamais prononcé le nom de Paul VI pendant la conférence. Comment pouvons-nous interpréter ce silence?
I missed that. Well, so. I'll answer about Paul the Sixth first. I did not speak about Paul the Sixth because I only had an hour to speak. If you read my book, you will see I speak about Paul the Sixth a great deal. And moving into the other question, one thing I've learned as a historian is that the continuities in history, and most especially in the church, are deeper, more fundamental, more persistent than any discontinuity or changes. And that is true also for the popes. Nonetheless, unless we take account of the differences, which means the changes, therefore the discontinuities, we don't know what's happening. It seems as if nothing happened. So Paul the Sixth was not John Paul the Second, and John Paul the Second is not Bergoglio, not Francis. Each of them has his own preoccupation and issues. As I said in my talk, I feel that Francis' non-participation in the council is an advantage because he is not reliving, even unconsciously, the issues and battles of the council. He can move to a sort of a higher level. I mean, I'm really amazed at how he seems to have
captured what I consider the main orientations of the council. His use, recovery really of the expression the people of God. Now, Paul VI never used that expression. Never used that expression. And I don't know about John Paul II. Perhaps he did, perhaps he didn't. But at any rate, it's been very prominent with Bergoglio. All at once, the episcopal collegiality. I mean, here is a very interesting fact, I think, that in the apostolic exhortation of 2 weeks ago, Evangelii Gaudium, he on several occasions quotes national episcopal conferences. As far as I know, no pope has ever done that in an official papal document. This is a recognition of a collegial nature of the church that is striking and therefore different, I mean new. It's a new emphasis. It's a new orientation. So those are wonderful indications, I think, of how he's grasped the what I consider the essence of the council and the think the dialogue with Rabbi Skorka. This is extraordinary. This went on for months. Then it was published. The dialogue was published. And as you know, translation of every language under the sun. That never happened. That is the dialogue recommended by Vatican II, now put into action. So these are really extremely significant developments, I think. And done and washing the feet of that Muslim woman. What a message. Well, also, I mean... Oh, all right. I could go on.
Voilà, donc le père O'Malley n'a pas parlé de Paul VI parce qu'il n'avait qu'une heure pour parler, et dans son livre, il en parle amplement. Comme historien, il a appris que les continuités dans l'histoire sont beaucoup plus fondamentales et profondes que toute discontinuité et que tout changement. C'est vrai pour l'Église, c'est vrai pour les papes. Mais si on ne prend pas en compte les changements, on dirait que rien ne se passe. Certes, Paul VI n'est pas Jean-Paul II, qui n'est pas non plus François. Chacun a ses propres préoccupations. Le fait que François n'a pas participé à Vatican II est un avantage, comme il a été dit dans la conférence, car il ne revit pas les batailles du Concile. Il peut aller à un niveau plus profond. Et ainsi, on peut voir qu'il a repris les plus grandes orientations du Concile, par exemple l'expression « peuple de Dieu » que Paul VI n'a jamais utilisée. Dans l'exhortation apostolique d'il y a 2 semaines, « Evangelii Gaudium », le pape François cite largement les conférences épiscopales nationales, ce que, selon le père O'Malley, jamais aucun pape n'avait fait dans des documents officiels jusqu'à présent. Donc il y a une reconnaissance là de la nature collégiale de l'Église et une nouvelle orientation. Il est revenu sur le fait que le dialogue avec le rabbin Skorka est vraiment extraordinaire, le fait que c'était publié, traduit et que ça durait des mois. Voilà une forme de dialogue que recommande Vatican II.
Perfect. And your question?
The question, it was the sharpness of the nature of Pope Francis's comments. Sometimes he's quite sharp in what he says. You said about Lampedusa, he did that once, but on several occasions he's used this gospel way of being sharp and trenchant. How would you say that? What could we call this sharpness of the gospel and not use it as something condemning but typical of the gospel?
Well, I mean, it's Christian to proclaim the gospel. And the gospel message is in many ways against the world, the flesh and the devil. So any pope, any Christian must do this. Now, there's a question again of style, how you do this. If you do this in a way that is self-righteous, self-justifying, as did the Pharisees, this is not Christian, even though it may be sharp and absolute. So I think as Christians, we walk this line between being of the world, reconciled to the world, and not being of the world, not reconciled to the world. And that's the paradox of being a Christian. I don't know that there's any formula that would resolve that problem. And certainly, what is interesting, I think, with the dialogue with Skorka is he's, in this case, he simply wants to listen. So the first thing before condemning is to listen and then decide if you need to condemn. So I think that would be my answer.
Alors, il est chrétien de proclamer l'évangile, et donc le message évangélique, on le constatait souvent, à la fois contre le monde, la chair, le diable. Tout pape et tout chrétien doit tenir ce discours, mais il y a une question de style. Comment tenir ce discours? Si on le fait de façon à s'auto-justifier ou à juger les autres comme l'ont fait les pharisiens, ce n'est pas chrétien, bien que cela soit tranchant. Et donc, comme chrétiens, nous marchons dans un équilibre entre être dans le monde et réconcilier avec lui et ne pas être dans le monde et pas réconcilier avec lui. Donc il y a là un paradoxe. Il n'y a pas de formule qui résolve ce problème, mais le dialogue avec le rabbin Skorka est un bon exemple du fait qu'il faut écouter avant de condamner le cas échéant si c'est nécessaire.
Merci beaucoup. On peut peut-être prendre d'autres questions.
Il semble que le pontificat de Jean-Paul II, à sa manière, mais encore plus celui de Benoît XVI, je me réfère au discours de Noël 2005 à la Curie romaine, et puis son dernier discours le jeudi saint après sa renonciation, ait consisté à combattre de manière extrêmement radicale l'esprit du concile. Benoît XVI, en un mot, tentant de faire revenir les catholiques à la lettre du concile dans justement pour éviter cette rupture, la fameuse continuité. Or, il apparaît dans votre conférence et il apparaît jusque-là que pape François revient à l'esprit du concile, justement. Vous l'avez presque exprimé sans le dire. Vous dites qu'il revient au noyau, il revient à l'intuition fondamentale de Jean 23 et apparaît, et c'est le sens de ma question, non pas une réconciliation, mais une contradiction, pas tant entre François et Benoît XVI et Jean-Paul II, admettons que ce sont des papes et ils s'entendent, mais dans l'Église semble revenir un conflit, justement, entre ces deux termes, et il ne me semble pas que la réconciliation soit pour demain.
Non, ok, so. During the pontificate of John Paul II and Benedict XVI, they fought in a radical way the spirit of the council. Benedict tried to bring Catholics back to the letter of the council, whereas Francis, in so many words, returns to the spirit of the council. So the question is, why did you use the word reconciliation when, in fact, it seems we're returning to a contradiction between two different styles of being in the church? One that would be continuity, the other discontinuity, I guess.
Well, this is a question of how one interprets the Second Vatican Council. And as I said, the Council is an extraordinarily complex reality. And it covers every aspect of Catholicism.
And it, of course, we believe the council is inspired, but it is still a human instrument, speaking human language with human limitations. So one can see discontinuities within the council itself, and it's possible to stay, it seems, true to the council by emphasizing some points and not other points. So my point is, you have to be clear about your method. And I think my method is right. That is to look at the council, as interpreting any historical document, there's always a give and take. There's always room. But some interpretations are truer to the totality. And I think that for whatever reason, however you explain it, Francis has grasped this. So what is my method is, yes, look at the recurring themes. Look at the recurring orientation. Look at the language. What is striking about Vatican II is it uses words uncommon in councils, common to Christian vocabulary, but uncommon in councils. And this begins to tell you, to give you a synthetic view of the council. So I don't like to say that John Paul II or Benedict XVI were not true to the council. I would say that they may have been true to some part of the council, some aspect of the council, but I think that as Bergoglio has acted and spoken in the past 8 months, he's shown us what I think is a basic orientation and, if you want to use the word spirit of the council, I think he does it.
Alors, la question est de comment on interprète Vatican II. Un concile est une réalité très complexe. Celui-ci, Vatican II, a couvert tous les aspects du catholicisme. Nous croyons que le concile est inspiré, mais il est aussi un instrument humain qui utilise un langage humain et des limites humaines. Et donc, on peut à la fois voir des discontinuités au sein même du concile, et puis, par ailleurs, on peut choisir de rester fidèle au concile en soulignant quelques points plutôt que d'autres. L'avis de John O'Malley, c'est qu'il faut être très clair sur la méthode qu'on emploie. Lui pense que sa méthode est la bonne, c'est-à-dire qu'il faut regarder, comme quand on interprète tout document historique, à la fois avec de la marge d'interprétation, mais aussi il y a des interprétations qui sont plus fidèles que d'autres. En particulier, il s'agit d'être fidèle à l'ensemble des documents. Et donc, François a compris cela, en fait, depuis qu'il est pape. Et, voilà, si vous regardez les thèmes récurrents, l'orientation, le langage dans Vatican II, il y a des mots qui sont employés dans ce concile qui, bien qu'ils soient chrétiens, n'ont pas été beaucoup employés dans les conciles précédents. Et donc, on peut obtenir une vue synthétique du concile. Le père O'Malley n'aime pas dire que Jean-Paul II et Benoît XVI ont été infidèles au concile, car ils ont été fidèles à certaines parties du concile, à tout le moins, mais peut-être François rejoint davantage l'esprit du concile.
Professor O'Malley, something we're extremely curious about within the Francis factor, as you stated, is something you may not be totally aware of or as acutely as we are, because I am speaking from without the company of Jesus, whereas yourself, and I notice all the gentlemen surrounding you are speaking from within. Now, what about the Jesuit factor?
Donc, je traduis vite la question. Je ne suis pas sûr que tout le monde ait compris dans la salle. Quid du facteur jésuite en plus du facteur François?
But I mean, your remark about the Pope's attention to national bodies or the collegiate bodies of the Church encourages me, because if there is one body of the Church that is widely different from, the totality of Christians, it is the Jesuits. The Pope is already very original insofar as he is from that region which contains the greatest number of Christians. So that should be a very important historical factor and very novel in the evolution of the papacy. Now, there is another one, which is he's coming from the company of Jesus, whose sociology is extraordinary. I mean, I think that a large number of Jesuits come from non-Christian countries, countries which are in majority non-Christians. And there is a potential for creativity and change there, which is enormous. I mean, would you care to discuss those things?
Donc le fait que François en particulier soit jésuite est encourageant, peut-être encore plus que le fait qu'il se soit référé à des conférences épiscopales, et outre le fait qu'il vient de l'Amérique latine, c'est-à-dire l'endroit où il y a le plus de catholiques actuellement, il y a donc selon la question l'originalité des jésuites dans le fait qu'ils viendraient de pays en majorité non chrétiens.
Okay. This is difficult to answer. We Jesuits, I think, never dreamed that there would ever be a Jesuit Pope, for many reasons. Nobody in the Church was more shocked on March the 13th than were members of the Society of Jesus. I was in Rome at the time, and we couldn't believe it. Even though the world perhaps should have been prepared, because he had been so close to being the second possibility in the previous election. I cannot read his soul, but what he talks so clearly about, what we might call his ongoing conversion after he was provincial of the Jesuits and then became auxiliary bishop and then became archbishop. And I find that very Jesuit and very reflective upon what was happening out there and what was happening in here, and a willingness to change and seeing the necessity of changing as he saw it. And then there is the whole question of his style. I used to tell people that in Rome, if you walk into the Roman Curia and then you walk into the Jesuit Curia, You can't believe they're both curious. They are so essentially different. I mean, you walk into the Jesuit Curia, and people are running around, and, you know, hello, yeah, well, the general's up on the third floor. Yeah, see if you can see him. There's no protocol. The general eats his meals with the rest of the community. Jesuit provincials, as for all other religious orders, they're elected for a certain period, and then they have to go back into the ranks. So his whole style, I mean, the fact that he's not living in the apostolic palace, the fact that he has people sitting with him at table, I mean, this is very Jesuit. It might sound sort of superficial, but I don't think it is. I think it's a way of being Christian and an aspect of the church as what shall I say? More egalitarian.
Alors, nous n'avons jamais rêvé qu'il y aurait un pape jésuite. En tant que jésuite, nous ne l'avons jamais rêvé. Personne n'a été plus choqué le 13 mars que les jésuites. Ce jour-là, le père O'Malley était à Rome et autour de lui, les compagnons n'y croyaient pas, bien qu'on aurait dû s'y préparer à cause du résultat connu de l'élection papale précédente. Le père O'Malley dit qu'il ne peut pas lire, évidemment, dans l'âme du pape François, mais, par exemple, ses propos très clairs sur sa conversion continue après son provincialat, puis son chemin comme évêque auxiliaire, puis évêque cardinal, etc. Voilà, c'est très jésuite d'y réfléchir a posteriori et puis de voir ce qui se passe à l'extérieur et également à l'intérieur, dans le cœur, voilà, et de voir ce qu'il faut changer. Donc ça, c'est très jésuite. Après, il y a la question du style du pape François. Le père O'Malley disait que a l'habitude de dire que si on va à Rome et qu'on va à la curie romaine puis à la curie généraliste des jésuites, on a du mal à croire que ce sont deux curies parce qu'elles sont si différentes. Si vous allez à la curie jésuite, les gens courent partout. Ils vous disent d'aller facilement trouver le père général au troisième étage. Celui-ci mange avec tout le monde sans protocole. Donc voilà, le fait que le pape François ait choisi de ne pas habiter au palais apostolique dit quelque chose d'une façon beaucoup plus égalitaire de vivre sa vie, voilà, qui est un aspect possible de la vie dans l'Église.
On peut prendre une autre question. Merci pour votre conférence. J'ai eu l'occasion à plusieurs reprises de présenter la déclaration Nostra Aetate et la déclaration Dignitatis Humanae, encore la semaine dernière, dans un diocèse de France. Je suis souvent frappé par le fait que, en France au moins, les gens réagissent de façon très, très positive à la déclaration Dignitatis Humanae, en étant très sensibles à l'actualité de cette déclaration et aussi à sa forme. Tandis que pour Nostra Aetate, parfois, j'ai encore entendu cela la semaine dernière, ils sont sensibles au fait que certains passages paraissent davantage datés, compte tenu des évolutions du paysage religieux, et notamment pour ce qui est de l'Europe, compte tenu d'une plus grande présence de l'islam. Alors comment réagir face à ces réactions ou à ces objections que l'on entend? Est-ce que ce serait par exemple justement en attirant l'attention sur l'esprit de Nostra Aetate, qui est plus d'inciter au dialogue, de préconiser une certaine attitude vis-à-vis des autres croyants, plutôt que de se prononcer sur le tout, la totalité de chacune des religions présentées.
He says when he goes to the diocese, talks about Nostra Aetate and Dignitatis Humanae, he's struck by the fact that Catholics typically react very favorably to Dignitatis Humanae. Still today, they accept the whole of the text. Whereas in Nostra Aetate, it seems that certain parts are outdated already. For instance, the fact there are many Muslims. So how should we interpret Nostra Aetate? Should it be taken, should we try to find the spirit of that document, like the dialogue, which is in it? How should we present Nostra Aetate today?
Yes, well, I think that with any of the council documents, they're historical documents. They're 50 years old.
So they come out of a very specific historical epoch, historical situation. So we have to take that into account and say, what's the essence of it? What's it driving at? What is sort of transcends this particular of the times? And certainly with the, I mean, not simply in France, I think especially in France and Western Europe, but even in the United States, the question of the Muslims is a big question and worldwide. And I think the basic fact, basic message of Nostra Aetate is the Christian message, hate is out. No hate. And no going to war for religion. We must try to live together and respect one another. And that's not always easy. And every situation requires a prudential judgment as to how to deal with it. So I think that's the turn of Nostra Aetate with the Jews. They're not an accursed people. We cannot speak badly about them as a religion, as a people. But that doesn't solve the particular problems of how on a day-to-day basis or over the course of decades we're to deal with them in practical terms. So, yes, I understand that. I understand that problem. But as I said, no violence with violence, and the Christian way is to wash the feet of one's enemies. So let's talk about a prophetic message of the gospel. That's one. And it's not just being nice to people, because it's not nice always to be nice. Thanks.
Les documents du Concile ont 50 ans, donc effectivement, il faut se demander, au-delà des détails du texte, quelle en est l'essence ou le but. La question des musulmans et de l'islam n'est pas seulement aiguë en France, en Europe, mais aux États-Unis et même dans le monde entier. Le message de base de Nostra Aetate, c'est qu'il ne faut plus haïr et il ne faut plus de guerre de religion. Il faut vivre ensemble et se respecter, ce qui n'est pas toujours facile après au concret. Et chaque situation appelle un jugement prudentiel pour le cas d'espèce. C'est ça le tournant de Nostra Aetate. Par exemple, les Juifs ne sont pas un peuple maudit, mais ça ne dit pas comment, voilà, ça c'est le principe, mais ça ne dit pas comment résoudre les problèmes quotidiens. Bon, le fait en revanche de laver les pieds de ses ennemis, c'est pas juste être gentil que de laver les pieds des autres. Parfois, il est difficile d'être gentil, c'est vraiment un message prophétique et proprement évangélique.
Merci John pour ces perspectives. On entend parfois dire qu'il nous faudrait désormais un concile Vatican III. J'aimerais savoir ce que vous en pensez. Est-ce que c'est une perspective souhaitable, dangereuse, impossible? Et est-ce que vous pensez que dans les perspectives du pape François, puisqu'il n'a pas connu le concile Vatican II, l'idée d'un concile Vatican III pourrait germer dans son esprit? Ou au contraire, est-ce qu'il ne pense pas plutôt, pour autant que vous puissiez savoir, que le Vatican II a ouvert un immense chantier qui est loin d'avoir été achevé, en particulier les conférences nationales qui ont été vidées de contenu par Jean-Paul II, ou les synodes des évêques qui, je dirais, n'intéressent à peu près plus personne pour la même raison, parce que vidées de contenu? Alors, qu'est-ce que vous pensez de la chose? Est-ce qu'il nous faut un Vatican III ou un chantier ferme et continu de mise en œuvre des perspectives Vatican II? Qu'est-ce qu'on peut attendre là-dessus du pape François?
I did, yes. I have a very clear answer. Vatican III
never. Why not Buenos Aires won? Why not Manila won? Why not Paris won? One of the problems of Vatican II was it was in the Vatican. This was a practical solution. It made sense, but it created so many problems because it was right in the machinery that the council wanted to deal with. So remember the first eight councils were held in Turkey. then in the Middle Ages, Leon I and II and Constance and Basel and so forth, and Vienne, and Trent, the popes did not want the council at Trent because it was too out of their control. It was too far away. And every council since the 15th century and even before that has dealt with reform of the papacy. That is to say, how does this primacy function? And if you're at the center of the function, the traditional function, the ongoing function, it's difficult to address that question. So that's one piece of the answer. A second piece is, for Vatican II, there were about 2,800 bishops in the world, of which roughly 2,100 were more at the council, more or less all the time. They filled St. Peter's. Now I think there are about 7,000. Where do you hold it? What amphitheater? It'd be even more unmanageable. So another way of dealing with it has to be found, I think. I think a council after the pattern of Vatican II is unmanageable today. So I don't know what to do about it.
Donc la réponse est très claire. Le père O'Malley ne veut jamais qu'il y ait de Vatican III. Pourquoi est-ce qu'il n'y aurait pas un Buenos Aires 1 ou Manille 1 ou même Paris 1? Le problème de Vatican II, c'est justement qu'il a eu lieu au Vatican, ce qui était pratique et avait un sens, mais en même temps a créé beaucoup de problèmes, car on se trouvait au centre de la salle des machines dont le concile voulait justement traiter. Les huit premiers conciles ont eu lieu en Turquie, puis au Moyen-Âge, on a eu Lyon 1, Lyon 2, Vienne, Constance, 30. Les papes, en fait, ne voulaient pas que le concile se tienne à 30 parce que c'était trop loin de leur pouvoir, car en fait, tout concile a traité de la réforme de la papauté, en particulier à partir du XVe siècle. La question, c'était comment fonctionne le primat du pape. Et évidemment, si on est au centre de fonctionnement de l'institution, il est difficile de répondre à cette question. Et deuxième aspect de la réponse, à Vatican II, il y avait à peu près 2800 évêques dans le monde, dont 2100 étaient au concile, ce qui a déjà rempli Saint-Pierre. Aujourd'hui, quand il y a 7000 évêques dans le monde, dans quelle salle est-ce qu'on pourrait tous les réunir? Certainement, il faudrait prendre le problème autrement pour des raisons pratiques. Donc, on ne peut pas refaire un Vatican II.
Merci. Est-ce qu'il y a une autre question?
If I can ask in English, otherwise you'll hear my bad French. In your experience as historian, I'm wondering what signs of the times that you see that or that the Pope Francis might see that might influence his view or his goals, because as we had the philosophy, the dynamism of John Paul II, and avec the theology, the liturgy, of Benedict XVI, and now we're 50, 60 years. The waves have settled. We don't have all of the controversy of the 60s and 70s. And of course, the world has already changed a lot since the 1960s with the technology. And just wondering your point of view on what signs of the times maybe the Holy Father sees right now, and in giving him his perspective. Is it right now a new time to really put into effect for everybody the fruits of the new breath of the Holy Spirit that the Second Vatican Council wanted to for the holiness of all people?
Je traduis brièvement. Dans votre expérience comme historien, et aussi comment est-ce que vous voyez, enfin comment est-ce que vous et le pape François voyez les signes des temps aujourd'hui? Bon, à l'époque de Jean-Paul II, on peut dire qu'il y avait la philosophie, le dynamisme, sous Benoît XVI, la théologie et la liturgie. Aujourd'hui, on a dépassé les controverses des années 1960-70. Le monde a déjà beaucoup changé. Quels sont les signes des temps pour voir l'Esprit Saint qui souffle aujourd'hui?
Well, again, I can't speak for Pope Francis, but I think that he gave a good indication when, I think it was 2 days after he was elected, he explained why he chose the name Francis. And he said he did it for three reasons. One was because of Pope Francis' love of the poor, his love for peace, and his love for nature. I think that maybe this is a reading of the signs of the times. As he just said, I think yesterday or today, that this scandal that a billion people of the world are without sufficient food in a world where there's plenty of food, is cries out to each and every one of us. So it seems to me that's one of the signs of the times that he sees. The tense international situation. I mean, there are wars going on, and there's a threat of more wars, and this is bad, this is horrible. What can we do? This is a part of the Christian message, and then the problem of our planet. So there are three signs of the times. And then the visit to Lampedusa, again, the indifference to human suffering, of which hunger would be one of the signs. So his vision is very outward-looking, while it seems to me at the same time very close to the gospel. I think, again, I mean, I think for me those words of John the 23rd are so key to what John the 23rd saw as the very essence of the church. And I think that Francis sees things the same way. The loving mother of all, benign, patient, full of mercy and goodness. And that's not easy.
Alors, François a donné une première indication de sa lecture des signes des temps 2 jours après son élection, en tout cas quand il a expliqué le nom qu'il a choisi avec 3 raisons. Son amour des pauvres, le désir de la paix et le respect de la nature. Donc ça, on peut dire que c'est une lecture des signes des temps. Hier ou aujourd'hui, il a aussi, c'est une façon de lire les signes des temps, ce message dans lequel il dit que le fait que 1 milliard de personnes sur Terre n'ont pas assez à manger doit nous toucher tous comme un cri. Il y aurait évidemment aussi, comme s'il détend, la situation internationale tendue, les guerres actuelles et possibles. Que faire là? Que faire pour la planète? Sa visite à Lampedusa est aussi une lecture des signes des temps, en particulier par rapport à l'indifférence mondialisée, par rapport à la souffrance humaine. Donc cette vision consiste à regarder à la fois ce qui se passe à l'extérieur, mais aussi rester proche de l'Évangile, c'est ça que fait le pape. Et en cela, il se rapproche beaucoup des mots de Jean 23 qui ont été cités dans la conférence, que l'essence de l'Église, c'est d'être une mère qui aime tous, qui est patiente avec tous et qui est pleine de bonté et de miséricorde.
Il y avait une autre question là, non ?
Bonsoir, ça marche ? Oui. J'aurais aimé interroger votre rôle, votre place particulière en tant que religieux, historien, mais aussi historien du religieux. J'aurais voulu savoir comment vous vous placiez dans ce rôle-là, par rapport, vous êtes professeur d'université aux États-Unis, vous êtes religieux, vous travaillez avec sans doute un avantage sur les textes, notamment ceux du Concile, avec une vision particulière, une analyse particulière. En même temps, est-ce que vous n'avez pas aussi un handicap par rapport à vos confrères laïcs? Est-ce que vous n'êtes pas plus ou moins consciemment limité dans votre analyse critique, notamment? Il y a une certaine loyauté que je peux imaginer aussi. Merci.
Okay. You're both a religious man who's a historian and a historian of the religious facts. You're a university professor in the States. Does the fact you're religious, is it a handicap that impedes you from seeing certain things, of having enough criticism as compared to your secular counterparts?
I'm as critical as my secular counterparts. And perhaps more critical. But, of course, each and every one of us is bound by his or her limitations. So, yes, I don't profess to have a unbiased, unprejudiced, comprehensive, neutral approach. What I try to do is be as self-critical as possible. And that's what we all must do, and to recognize who and what I am, and therefore what my bias might be. So, yes, I'm limited as a priest, as a religious, as an American, believe it or not, and as a human being, as we all are. So, what can I say? The important fact for any scholar is the self-criticism, and to listen to criticism, and to try to take it into account, even though it sometimes hurts very much. But that's our job. And so that's all I can say. I mean, that's the way it is. None of us can step out of himself, or none of us can step out of herself. There's no way to do that.
Donc je suis aussi, voire même plus critique que mes confrères laïcs, mais bien sûr chacun d'entre nous est limité, donc je n'ai pas de vision neutre ou sans préjugés qui ne soit pas biaisée. Ce que j'essaye, c'est d'être autocritique dans la mesure du possible, et de voir en quoi je suis biaisé. Je suis limité, bien sûr, comme prêtre, comme religieux, même comme Américain, et comme être humain, comme nous tous. Tout universitaire doit être autocritique et écouter aussi les critiques des autres, même quand ça fait mal, mais ça fait partie de notre boulot.
Merci. Question de...
Oui, je suis frappé du fait que vous avez beaucoup rapproché Jean 23 et le pape François dans votre commentaire du Concile, mais je pense que vous pourriez aussi dire d'autres éléments de comparaison entre les deux papes. Est-ce que vous auriez envie de développer cet aspect? On pourrait dire que Jean 23 a aussi un style pastoral, une expérience internationale, un style simple. Voilà, est-ce qu'on pourrait, je dirais, tirer quelques enseignements de ce rapprochement?
Other similarities. Yeah, between John the 23rd and Pope Francis, could you elaborate on the similarities?
Well, I think you have already suggested some of the similarities. The for one thing, they both came. They were neither of them was a candidate from the center. John the 23rd, although he was a papal diplomat, was out of the center. He was in Bulgaria, then he was in Turkey, then he was in Paris, then he was in Venice. The Francis was from Argentina, completely different. He was a Jesuit. So there, they were not, I mean, Paul the sixth, Pius the 12th, were very much from the center. John Paul II was not from the center, but he was from a very constrained, a difficult siege situation that gave him a certain vision, whereas I think these other two were freer to move around and see more, be more in touch with what was going on as we know the world today. That is to say, this kind of secular world, this busy world, this distracted world. And their pastoral instincts. So I see them really as sort of kindred souls. I mean, very different, but I see them as more alike than I see either of them as like Paul the Sixth or like John Paul the Second or like Benedict the Sixteenth.
Donc, vous avez déjà suggéré des éléments de réponse à votre question. Jean 23 et François ne sont pas des candidats du centre, au sens que, bien que Jean 23 fût diplomate, il était loin du centre, en Bulgarie, en Turquie, puis Paris et Venise. François, qui vient d'Argentine et comme jésuite, voilà, ne sont pas comme Paul VI et Pie XII, qui étaient des candidats du centre. Jean-Paul II, même s'il n'était pas du centre, venait d'une situation très difficile où il était assiégé et qui lui donnait une vision particulière. Jean 23 et François sont plus libres peut-être que les autres papes récents pour voir le monde d'aujourd'hui, pour le regarder, regarder ce monde distrait et affairé avec leur instinct pastoral, cet instinct qu'ils partagent et qui en fait comme des âmes sœurs.
Merci. On a encore le temps peut-être pour une voire deux questions. Et... Il y a trois candidats.
In your presentation, you've mentioned some of the ways Francis has implemented Vatican II. My question is, what other aspects of Vatican II still await to be put into practice? And what limitations could Francis encounter in doing so?
Donc la question c'est quels sont les autres aspects de Vatican II qui attendent d'être mis en œuvre et quelles difficultés le pape pourrait-il rencontrer pour cette mise en œuvre?
We can listen to question.
All right. No. Let me answer one at a time because otherwise I get confused. I get more confused. Well, he's one thing that he's not done that's very close to Vatican II, he's taken steps, is a closer implementation of collegiality as the council envisioned it. Just how that would work is another question, a very difficult practical question, but that's one aspect of it. And I think that to take the other side of your question, he's already experiencing resistance to what he's doing. So, I mean, there's a general enthusiasm, I find, certainly in the United States, but I think any place, certainly in Italy, there's a general enthusiasm and support for Francis. But that is certainly not universal and not universal within the church. And one of the founder of the St. Egidio community forget his name now. Oui. Yeah. Just said the other day that there's a kind of a lazy resistance to Francis. That is to say, people say, well, yes, it's wonderful, wonderful. Of course, we're doing that. So let's move on. And this is not what he's about. He's calling each of us to re-examine ourselves and to re-examine what we're doing. And so this sort of lazy resistance means lip service to him and sincere service, but not doing anything, not changing.
Voilà une chose que François n'a pas encore faite, c'est mettre en œuvre la collégialité qu'appelle Vatican II. La grosse question qui est très difficile, c'est la difficulté de la mise en œuvre pratique de la collégialité. Par ailleurs, sur la question de l'expérience de la résistance, on peut dire que François y a déjà fait face. Si d'un côté on note un enthousiasme général pour lui, en tout cas aux États-Unis et en Italie, mais même partout dans le monde, ce n'est pas universellement le cas, ni même universellement dans l'Église. Récemment, un des fondateurs de Sant'Egidio, donc Riccardi, disait qu'il y a une résistance paresseuse à François, de telle façon que les gens disent « oui, oui, c'est génial, on est déjà en train de faire ce qu'il fait », alors que, en fait, le pape François appelle chacun à s'examiner personnellement pour voir s'il fait ces choses, et il ne faut pas passer trop vite sur les suggestions du pape.
Alors, on entend la dernière question.
I would like, Father, to ask you about Pope Francis, if he will do something for the unity of the Church, because we have seen that the Patriarch of Constantinople came to participate, and during the visit of the other patriarchs. So what's your opinion? Shall he do something for the unity of the Church?
Oh, I think so.
La question, est-ce que le pape François va faire quelque chose pour l'unité de l'Église? On a déjà vu le patriarche de Constantinople venir avec les autres patriarches en visite à Rome. Qu'est-ce qu'il pourrait faire d'autre pour l'unité de l'Église?
Yes, I think that he has already established a sense of welcome and openness and informality, I suppose, that is certainly, I think, among Protestant churches, but also Orthodox, is being very positively received. What this will mean, of course, history is a strange beast. We don't know. But I would say the signs are better today than they have been in a long, long time, maybe not for the union of the churches, but for working more towards some kind of union and reunion, so for the unity of the church. So I think, I mean, the signs are good.
Voilà, donc le pape François a déjà établi un ton de bienvenue, d'ouverture, un style informel qui est bien reçu non seulement chez les protestants, mais aussi chez les orthodoxes. Ceci dit, quand sera-t-il vraiment? L'histoire est une bête étrange. Il y a certainement des signes meilleurs aujourd'hui en faveur, peut-être pas tout de suite, de l'union de toutes les églises, mais en tout cas du fait qu'on s'achemine vers une unité plus grande. Mais voilà, qu'est-ce que l'histoire en dira? C'est à voir.
Voilà. Mais merci beaucoup, encore une fois. Très grand merci aussi à Nicolas pour sa traduction. Et puis à...